Good morning. Welcome to the Second Court of Appeals. Your panel this morning is to my right, Justice Ann Gardner. To my left, Justice Lee Gabriel. I'm Leanne Dofino. And since you're our only case for today for oral submission and everything else is set for submission on briefs, we thought it might be easier for everybody to make it at 10:30 instead of during rush hour. So,
thank you.
Hope it helped a little bit.
It did.
All right, I understand everybody is ready to go. So, if you'll call our only case for oral submission, appreciate it.
The court calls Boone Care Concepts et al. Versus Richard Walsh et al. May it please the court, Mr. Brent Shawhorst and Mr. Max S. Kendall will represent the appellant. Mr. Ryan Logan Valdez, Mr. Jeff Kendall, and Mr. Lyndall Kirkley will represent the appellant.
All right. You ready, Brent?
May it please the court. The trial court in this case found the marketing agreement between the parties here an illegal agreement, and as a result of that, it entered a summary judgment in favor of the defendants. With all due respect, the trial court erred. This agreement is not illegal. First of all, it's not illegal on its face. That's not even an issue the court needs to address at this point. It's been conceded at page 3 of the SIR reply. And that conclusion is supported by a wealth of case law, including the Plano surgery case and others that we've cited to you in our brief. So what this court has to decide now is whether or not defendants have overcome the presumption of legality that exists for contracts by conclusively establishing it's illegal. And in order for them to conclusively establish that it is illegal, they have to prove that there is no possible way that this agreement can be performed in a lawful manner. I'll direct this court's attention to a case from this court called Groves. It's in our brief. And in the Groves court, it says, a contract that could have been performed lawfully, we don't declare it illegal, unenforceable, or void, merely because you could perform it illegally, or even if illegal acts were performed in carrying it out. It's just got to be possible to perform it illegally. That is their burden in order for them to prevail at summary judgment. Now, they have argued and asserted that we have waived our right to say they haven't met their burden. We respectfully disagree with that, Your Honors. Even if we hadn't filed a motion for a summary judgment response, we still could come to this court and say, here's the law, here's Groves, and the body of law going back to 47 that says their burden. And they have failed to conclusively establish with the evidence that they presented their entitlement to summary judgment. We can't waive that. We didn't waive that. But we did file a summary judgment response. They note in footnote 57 of their brief that we had some language, one sentence in our summary judgment reply that they say, well, this is probably what they're talking about, where they raised it, but it's not enough. Well, if it wasn't enough, it was unambiguous somehow, they had a duty to specially accept, and they didn't. But more importantly, that one sentence was not the only place we talked about it in our brief. We invite you to look at Clerk's Record 174 and 175, where we say, here's their burden. And then we say, defendant's evidence doesn't show an agreement for compensation of an illegal act, which is what's required under the anti-kickback statute. We list evidence outside the four corners of the agreement that show how we could perform legally and did perform legally. Then look at Clerk's Record 180 and 181, where we take their primary case they rely on so heavily, this nursing home case from a district court in Arkansas. And we say, here's where the Arkansas court said you ran afoul of the anti-kickback statute. And we compared it and contrasted it to our case that we could perform legally because we're not acting as intermediaries. We're not doing these referrals that was found unlawful in that case, so we could perform legally. Clerk's Record 181, we showed how we actually could perform legally. So we raised, I think, the issue that we could perform legally, and since we raised that, they can't claim that we have somehow waived that they have failed to meet the burden that this agreement couldn't be performed in a lawful manner. Now let's talk about what is really prohibited under this anti-kickback statute.
Excuse me a second.
Yes, ma'am.
I don't know if I just overlooked it. Who drafted this agreement?
I do not know the answer to that question.
Okay. Did you know which side drafted it, or did both sides draft it?
No lawyers that we know of. I think it was just the parties.
Together or one?
Together, I think
together?
So.
Is that in the record?
I don't believe that is in the record.
Okay. All right. If it's not in the record, I can't consider it.
All right, I understand. So let's turn what's prohibited. In their SIR reply, they've come up with six or seven things that they say are prohibited. And they've created this list by parsing the statute improperly, in our opinion. And it's done in a way that even FedEx would be potentially liable for delivering a Medicare reimbursable item. But that is not supported by the cases. The cases say what is prohibited is unlawful referrals and recommendations. And on that point, I'm going to direct the court to a Fifth Circuit case called U.S. v. Miles. It's in our brief, and I've got a little blow-up here. You had a tri-party relationship in that case. You had a company called APRO, and what they did was they provided home health services. They engaged a company called Premier to go out and market APRO. And what Premier would do was Premier would go out to doctor's offices in the Houston area, and it would extol the benefits of APRO. It would basically market for them. It would leave brochures, literature, business cards. Sometimes it would leave what my wife calls little sussy gifts, like plates of cookies, things like that. Then when a doctor decided that home health care services were needed, he or she would sometimes call Premier. Premier would take that information, give it to APRO. APRO would provide the product or service, bill Medicare, and it would pay Premier $300 each time this happened. At the trial court, the principals of APRO were convicted. But those convictions were reversed on appeal by the Fifth Circuit. And the Fifth Circuit's reasoning is very important here. The Fifth Circuit said, there's nothing unlawful here. The Miles case says, the anti-kickback statute is designed to prevent undue influence in the selection of products and services covered by a health care program. And what the Fifth Circuit says is, you're missing an element here. The element is that the payment, this $300 payment, has to be, quote, an inducement to the payee to refer the individual. That's at page 479 and 80. It then goes further and says, the problem you have is there's no evidence, that Premier over here had any authority to act on behalf of the doctor in deciding who got the business. The doctor decided home health care services was needed, and the doctor is the one who decided to call Premier. And so the Fifth Circuit goes on and says, look, the payments from APRO to Premier were not made to the relevant decision maker as an inducement for a kickback for sending patients. And so that arrangement here was not unlawful, because you didn't have the payment in return for a referral. You'll find that same sort of reasoning and logic in the Lacey case that we cited in our brief. May I leave the well for a moment, Your Honor?
Sure.
I want to compare and contrast that to you to a case called Poland. It is cited in the Fifth Circuit case. And here's where you get illegality. It's another tri-party relationship. But in Poland, you were dealing with pacemakers. And the salesman, Hobicorn, here, he sold the pacemakers, he intended the procedures, and all that was fine. The problem was, once a pacemaker is installed, the patients have to be monitored regularly. Hobicorn, the salesman, had arranged with these doctors that he could help them find and arrange for the monitoring services. So in that case, unlike Miles, the decision maker in that case was the salesman. And the arrangement with CVS, CVS was the monitoring service. They had said, everyone that you send to us, we'll give you $50. Well, in that case, the payment was being made to the person that was deciding where the business would go. That was what was unlawful in the Poland case. That was what was missing in the Miles case. In our case, Wound Care and the Andersons are never even A, B, and C. They're operating up here at a level outside this playing field.
Is this another criminal case?
These are criminal cases. That's where most of these that you find. Yes, Your Honor.
And you don't see any distinction?
No.
I know in your brief you try to argue that there has to be an intent
Right.
So do you not see any distinction?
This is not an intent question, Your Honor.
No.
At this level, no, I do not see a distinction, because both cases you have to have the payment for an inducement. If you look at the very language of A and B, it's you should not pay in return for a patient, in return for. So I think that's fundamental to whether it be civil or criminal. As far as what the evidence says, the evidence in the record shows that my clients did not market to patients or doctor or to the ultimate decision makers. Kim Anderson testified that we, being wound care, we didn't go out and get the referrals. The testimony from Dan Anderson is we didn't even identify the patients. What they did and what the record shows is they acted at a level up here where they would educate these salespeople on the products and services that they would go out into the marketplace and sell. And sales techniques. And so by operating up here, they're not creating any undue influence on a decision maker, which is what's required in those cases. For time purposes, unless you have any more questions, I'm going to rely on our brief for the intent issue, unless the court has any more questions.
Is it still your position that they have to prove intent?
Yes, ma'am.
Well,
you have that one case out of the Texas Court of Appeal Commission from 1926 that we've cited in our brief that says that the intent has to be both mutual and established at the time of the agreement was signed. So we think there is at least one Texas case that says intent is required. Now, appellees are going to have argued that the management services that are described in this agreement are the arranging and furnishing of services. Well, we respectfully disagree, but even with that, that's only one possible interpretation of the agreement. It's not necessarily the exclusive, so they can't prevail on summary judgment with just one possible interpretation. The other thing is they're missing that element that's talked about in Miles and in Lacey. You don't have the referral and the undue influence on a decision maker. The evidence shows, like I said, we could and did manage at a level that there would be no undue influence on a decision maker. You don't have that quid pro quo. Now, they argue that we, in SIR Reply 6, you'll see this sort of language, that we marketed products to Medicare patients, and they cite clerk's records 78 through 80. We invite you to look at 78 through 80. It doesn't say wound care marketed to patients. What it says is Medicare rents, Salesforce did. If you look at page 79, lines 18 through 24, it says wound care wasn't even actively engaged in the marketing to anyone.
But the agreement says that wound care is going to act as a marketing agent.
Yes, but again, that could be interpreted in several different ways. And the evidence that you have here that shows that we could perform in a lawful way was the way that we did it and we promoted was by training their sales force. Their sales force would go out and talk to the decision makers. They would bring back the paperwork. We'd put it all together. We would give it to Medicarents, and Medicarents would handle the billing and all that. We were just not involved with the decision maker. We were, working at a level where the payment didn't have an influence. We're more like the Miles case, where it is lawful, and there's a lawful way to perform it, except we're working one level even above that, one level removed from the decision maker. And to the extent the court disagrees with anything we've said here, there's still the safe harbor exception, and they have a duty. If you look at the Arlington v. McClure case that they've presented to the court, that says pretty clearly that since they're moving on their affirmative defense, they have a burden to disprove the safe harbor. It's cited in that 2008, and it's from this court. We provided an affidavit to the trial court that we claim was erroneously excluded. We've asked this court to correct that error of excluding the evidence. And when you do and you consider the evidence that's in there, it's evidence of what is called the Darden factors. The Darden factors are what the court must look at to decide the true relationship of these parties. It doesn't matter what they thought the relationship is or what they intended. The Darden factors are what you evaluate. And here that affidavit shows the control that they had, the detail over the work that we did for them, the additional work that they gave us outside the ones described, the tools that they gave us to carry out our work, the things that are in the Darden factors that you measure. You also couple that with the IRS ruling that says the sort of relationship that you have in this marketing agreement is indicative of an employment relationship. So all those factors, at a minimum, raise a fact issue on this safe harbor. And that's a fact issue that the Arlington v. McClure case says that they have to disprove. And with that, I'll turn it over to opposing counsel.
Thank you. Lyndall, you're going to argue? Is that right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
May it please this honorable court, my name is Lyndall Kirkley, and I represent MedRCO and Medical Rents. We filed this summary judgment because in reviewing the statute that applies on Medicare, after having gone through a substantial investigation ourselves, that this was an illegal contract, and the court granted that after hearing the presentation. With respect, I'm going to address the employee situation first, which under the Act, Medicare basically says, look, don't pay people commissions. If you're going to have them marketing and everything out there, then make them employees, or otherwise you run the risk. That's clear in the statute and clear in our briefs, that's the only way that you can eliminate the risk of having commissions paid and being in violation if your marketing products or have people out there earning a commission by recommending that they go to a particular place for the product. Medicare expanded the statute, as we pointed out, three times to make it as broad as they possibly could to capture every situation where there was the possibility of paying commissions in connection with marketing a product. As they did not plead under Rule 94 the employee situation. That was done after, in an affidavit, after their depositions were taken. What occurred in the case, as we point out, is they became, for some reason, disenchanted with medical rents when they were employees. They resigned from that employment. They left and formed their own corporation and worked for their own corporation, not medical rents. They worked for and were employees of that corporation. Point number two, we point out, a corporation cannot be an employee. It clearly spells out that a corporation in the acts we've cited cannot be an employee. So they worked for their own corporation, Wound Care Inc. And when they separated from us, what they decided they wanted to do, as we point out in there, was form their own company, market products that Medical Rents had, and become the representative of Medical Rents placing and arranging for these products that Medical Rents manufactured or had in its possession to go into various hospitals, nursing homes, whatever they were going to be placed. The statute, I point out, which is very significant in this case, especially on whether or not we proved whether or not it could be performed in a legal matter. We agree that when you look at the contract itself, that it doesn't show illegality on the face of the contract. When that occurs, you move to the next step under case law. You then have to prove that it cannot be performed in a legal matter. And in this particular case, we did that in the trial court. First of all, the statute on this that is critical says that a person can be held liable under the Act if they receive a payment, which may be, not is, may be, if they receive a payment which may be made in whole or in part under a federal health care program. So our contracts, the way they operate, you may or you may not know that Medicare, when they place these products, which in the contract they agree they're going to have the responsibility for placing, when you look at the contract, they will have the responsibility for placing the product in the hospital or with a nursing home or wherever this Medicare payment is likely to be made. We may not know that it's a Medicare payment, but we've paid back $120,000, including their commission to Medicare. They haven't paid any, but we've paid that back based on this arrangement to Medicare. Now, the statute goes further that says if they get a commission in return for purchasing, leasing, ordering, or arranging for, those two words are important, because once they started their own company, we did not arrange for the products to be in the nursing home or the hospitals. That was all handled outside of medical rents completely, not by us, completely handled outside of us by wound care. And they had control over, much like a loaned employee situation, the medical rent salespeople, they had control over those people as far as directing their activities and supervising them in connection with marketing. That's in the agreement. You can read that in the agreement, that it specifically provides they're going to be doing that. It specifically provides they'll be the one placing the product, and they're the ones that were arranging for the placement of the product. We proved that that was, in the trial court, an illegal arrangement. We are in a Hobson's choice situation. If we continue with the contract, we would be violating Medicare law. If we didn't continue, they would claim we were in breach of the contract. But because it's an illegal contract, we could not be put in that Hobson's choice position and had to terminate the contract for that reason, because it was illegal. The trial court clearly saw that in the proof that we presented. There's no way this contract can be performed legally, because there is no way to know, either them or us, how the payment is coming from Medicare and if it's a Medicare payment. So the statute places you in the position that I'm talking about when these products are placed, that because we're paying a commission and because Medicare is paying it and they're arranging for and placing those products, we'll be in violation.
So that, wouldn't you say, is probably why in the criminal prosecution of these cases, you have to have an intentional or knowing mental state to violate the statute?
In a criminal case, because mens rea is a higher standard that they imply for the criminal prosecution, but in the cases we've cited that are the civil cases, you'll see that they don't require that intent. In the cases that we've cited, in our briefs all throughout there, that the criminal cases have a much higher burden, and that is the intent. And as we point out in the cases we've cited, in those civil cases where they've raised these issues or they've come up where someone sued for breach of contract and the courts have held that they were an illegal contract, they're doing it on the basis of illegality under the statute as opposed to a criminal violation of the statute. Now, could Medicare come in here and pursue a criminal action? They probably could. There's no question they intended and had full knowledge when they entered into this agreement of the type of products that were being placed and where they were being placed.
So you're saying that if all they were doing under this contract was managing the sales force, not having contact with the ultimate decision maker, but managing the sales force and placing products out there, that the ultimate decision maker could decide, okay, I want that one or I don't want that one. I want a competitor's product. If that's all they're doing, because they're paid by a commission, this is illegal.
It's illegal because they are not simply managing, as they try and spin it in the brief. If you read the contract, they had complete control over the sales staff, the people that are placing those products. And when they're placing those products and getting a commission, it's getting the commission that's wrongful. in connection with the placing of the product. That's what's prohibited by the Medicare statute, and it's prohibited for arranging a situation where Medicare is going to be paying and someone's getting a commission. Now, obviously, the reason for that is they want to remove the incentive for placing products of some manufacturer like Medicarents. They want to remove the commission incentive that they make, and that's why they say that if you're going to do it, you got to make them employees, so you get rid of the commission, which tends to drive trying to place them even in. And if you're in nursing homes like they were, and you're selling to hospitals and nursing homes, you can pretty much count on the fact that a portion of your business, and you're not going to know when that occurs because it's the hospital that calls you or the nursing home, not the patient, that you're going to be getting Medicare payments. And so it's impossible to perform it because your contact is a hospital or a nursing home that calls and says, we need a, let's take our product, a Rojo mattress. Well, they're going to place that Rojo mattress, and they're going to get a commission for placing it. It can't be performed legally. Intent is not the criteria under the statute. As far as illegality goes, it is only intent in a criminal prosecution because of the mens rea.
And the statute, again, says if it's possible?
It says may. Whoever, in return for referring an individual to a person for the furnishing or arranging. They were clearly furnishing, and they were arranging. They arranged it through salespeople.
Yeah, just the statute, please. Whoever what?
Whoever furnishes or arranges for the furnishing of an item or service for which payment may be made.
May be made. Go ahead.
In whole or in part under a federal health care program, Medicare, Medicaid, any of these programs. So that presents for the company, and that's why this contract was terminated, a purely illegal situation that we could not control. The way this contract set up.
So if somebody is providing food on a commission basis, there's a food salesman, and they place food in a nursing home, and there's a Medicaid patient in the nursing home, and the stay is paid for by Medicaid. That person is violating a federal statute by working on commission and placing food?
Under this statute, the way that this actually operated, and the testimony in this case is that they did receive Medicare payments, and they expected to receive 20% commission on all of the Medicare payments.
So
that's in our brief.
A food broker who's placing food, selling food, has salesmen working on commission, placing food in nursing homes that could have Medicaid patients or Medicare patients.
The answer to that is no, ma'am, for this reason.
Okay.
The food provided to the nursing home is not under the Medicare provision. It's only those covered things. These are all covered items under Medicare with a specific code. And when you have those code products that are medical products, that's where the fraud is occurring all across the country, is these people that earn a commission based on placing these products.
The code products, not the
That's correct.
Product that could.
That's right. They all have code numbers. And when you place one of these Medicare, Medicaid covered products, food would not be in there. There are lots of things that are not in there. It's those medical devices and things that have a specific code number like all of ours did.
And that's listed in the statute you're referring to.
It's under the Medicare regulations.
But not in the statute you're referring to.
Well, it says health care program. That would include the regulations.
Okay.
And so, and I just point out to you again on the employee situation, I recognize this court is one of the courts that still has not addressed or has addressed but has not abandoned the sham affidavit, but they all testified they were not employees under that provision that in their depositions, and it was only when we filed a summary judgment that they came back with this spin that says we were treated like employees. Well, under the Constitution since the 16th Amendment, once they resigned, just as if each one of you got up and walked off and said, I quit today. Under our Constitution, once a person resigns, they're no longer obligated to do anything in the employer-employee relationship. There's no involuntary servitude, and they chose to go to work for their own corporation, run their own business, and do their own thing. And they were not employees of Medical Rents, nor did they plead that under Rule 94. And they, as a matter of fact, turned in resignations and resigned from employment. And you can't force somebody, you can't make somebody an employee if they had a desire not to be an employee. Their whole purpose in starting their own operation was not to be an employee.
Not saying I agree or disagree with that, but as I recall, in your brief, you make reference to the fact that they only made this correction after you filed your motion for summary judgment, but there's nothing in the record to support that, is there?
Just the dates, yes. There, by dates, there is.
There's dates in the record that show when they filed their corrections to the deposition.
That's
and
correct.
After
our,
date
the date of our motion is in the record, and the date of their affidavit is in the record.
Because okay. I know it's their position. There's nothing in the record to support that. So, and I didn't have the record in front of me. That's why I'm asking. But I can assure you it will be checked out. I'm just
Yeah. Still, they would have to plead it under 94. There's no pleading of an affirmative defense.
I understand that. I just wanted to know if you're telling me there's something in there.
Yeah. I think if you take the summary judgment motion that's in the record and you take the affidavit they refer to, you have dates on both of those.
Okay.
Any other questions?
No.
Thank you.
May I? First of all, let's talk about this allegation that we came up with this fabrication of employee status. Look at Clerk's Record 225. 4 months after the agreement was signed, their principal signed a document under criminal perjury that said Mr. Anderson was an employee and that employment relationship was likely to continue. They thought we were employees. They at least represented it. And as to your question, Justice Gabriel, the correction, the errata sheet, even if it was filed after the summary judgment was filed, I don't know that personally, but even if it was filed, there's no evidence that it wasn't filed in the time allowed for law to correct depositions. As far as the marketing agreement never says the word arrange. The marketing agreement says manage. When you look at the statute, it says, actually, whoever knowingly or willfully solicits or receives any remuneration, including kickback, bribe, or rebate, directly or indirectly, in cash or in kind, Part B, in return for. That's what the Miles case, that's what the Lacey Court case is focusing on. Justice Dofano, your question was right on point. If you accept their argument, how can FedEx take a covered item, and if FedEx is the one delivering it and charges for that, if it's not an employee, how is FedEx not liable under that statute, under their interpretation? Another important thing I want to point out, when they talk about this case, let's go right here and say that this is Medica Rents. This is Medica Rents salespeople. They forget to talk about what their salespeople do. He tells you what our folks did. What was his sales folks doing? They were the ones that went out and arranged. They're the ones that went out to the doctor's offices and said, hey, our product's better than the competition. Choose us. When you decide to choose, choose us. Again, that's the salespeople. Medica Rents employees, not us. We operate up here, and it is possible for us to operate at this level. Train them before they go out in the field, how to win friends and influence people, those kind of things. Sales techniques, our product's better than their product. Choose us when you need a Rojo mattress or a bandage. So ultimately, it comes down to one question. Is it possible that we could perform lawfully? And I think there's absolutely no question. You look at the civil cases, the criminal cases, operating at the level we did where there was no payment in return for the purchase of equipment, the referrals, is not unlawful under this act. We would ask the court to reverse the rendition of summary judgment, send this back to the trial court for trial on the matter below. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Oh, we appreciate your argument. As you could tell, we did have questions. And your case is submitted.